And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, and with me is Phil Condon. How are you doing, Phil?
Yes, good afternoon, Phil.
So, Phil, you did not see the Super Bowl.
I saw one quarter of it. It was pretty
You saw them quartered? They were quartered.
Yeah,
you saw that.
Yeah, I watched the guy run back an interception of a 70-yard score, a touchdown. That was
Okay.
I said, I could see where this thing's going to end up, so that was enough.
I thought it was a great moment for Black History Month because the quarterback, Russell Wilson, is the great-great-grandson, he says, of a slave who was particularly interesting in that this great-great-grandfather was the personal slave to a Confederate colonel who also lost in a Super Bowl, and the slaves were freed. This is the second time Denver has been terribly embarrassed when they were going into a Super Bowl, favored to win by 3. In 1988, they went into the Super Bowl, and they said, we're going to win because we have the Denver Cowboys, and we got John Elway, who's the most marvelous blonde, blue-eyed quarterback in America. And what does the Washington Redskins have? Well, they have Doug Williams, the first black quarterback to be in the Super Bowl. And Doug Williams won 42-10. He killed him. He threw four touchdown passes in the second quarter. I'll never forget it. Elway, of course, will never forget it either. I think Denver might want to think about this. They may be under a curse. Because, you see, the only thing I thought about, because I didn't care, frankly, who was going to win, until I started thinking the way we all do politically, you know, like, well, who likes this and that? And I found that Manning and Elway gave money to the Mitt Romney campaign, which is, you know, kind of lending money to King Croesus, right? Mitt Romney's a billionaire Republican, and he
maybe Manning is too
candidate for president in 2012. And Peyton Manning, gave him money. He didn't just say, oh, I like him. No, he gave him money. And John Elway gave him money. So, you see, I think they put themselves unnecessarily at risk. You know, because sport, you know, if you're not superstitious, you shouldn't get near sports. Sport is all about superstition. You have to know just, you know, what to put on your socks right, and if you don't have them, take them off and start again. So that's what happened. Just to remind you, so the first black quarterback to be in a Super Bowl, Doug Williams as a starter, he won it 42-10 over Denver. The second one of note, I'm sorry, not the second to play in the Super Bowl after, but the second one to defeat Denver was Russell Wilson. And if you look at it, the game was mishyped somewhat because of what I would call white chauvinist thinking. Why is Manning supposed to win? Well, because he's a wise old veteran, and the wise old veterans, they get in these ball games, and that's the guy you want behind, you know. So, okay, Phil, did you see the first down of the game?
No.
The very first play?
No.
Okay, the wise old veteran, the guy who can raise his arms and yell Omaha and give signals and take complete command of the playing field, he was talking and looking in various directions when the center thought he heard the snap count. So he snapped it. It bounced off Manning's head, I think, and bounded into the end zone and was immediately fallen upon by one of the smarter Denver players for a safety. So it's quickest.
That explains the 8-0 score. I said, how do you get 8 points in a football game?
You have to really, you know, that again. I got to hand it to Denver. They're a team. They went out there and they as a team, they all screwed up. It was like they stuck together. Their quarterback screwed up, center screwed up.
Yeah.
They said, the defensive back says, well, now it's my job. I got to go and screw up. And they definitely did. But in fact, they got beat by a better team. But I go back. If you thought about this game, you would be calculating that an excellent defense is playing an excellent offense. So that's what they told us. Immediately, the rule of thumb in sport is the team that plays the best defense will prevail. Not every time, but they generally prevail. So right away, everybody should have been saying, be careful about your guessing here. And then this idea that a young quarterback can't beat an old one, that is is sheer football stupidity. The question is, what can the younger one do? And Mr. Wilson, by the way, he happens to be the shortest quarterback in the NFL. He's 5'10". They call him 5'11" to flatter him, but he's actually 5'10". He's also a Major League Baseball prospect. I don't know if you know that he was a number one pick. He, if he wanted, could play for the Blue Jays next year. He's that good, or this year. I wouldn't rule out, and I don't think he's ruled out, that he might eventually, he might do it anyhow, because that's how good he is. But his skill set is he can throw the ball as well as anybody, but he also has quick feet. So if you cause him a little bit of a problem, he will take off. Now, nobody claims that Manning is going to take off. If you get him into a problem, the problem gets worse, and that's what happened. But I do. I think it's a. I'm very pleased. This is Black History Month. How better to celebrate? Bang! Right out of the blocks, a black quarterback wins the Super Bowl and murders him, and against a general manager and a quarterback who were Mitt Romney fans. So my cup runneth over. I think it's a great.
I'm thinking of all kinds of military metaphors for this game. You know.
Oh, the military, by the way, was all over this game. Yeah. They're getting all over hockey. They're getting all over our sports pages. I want our sports section to get in touch with the editorial section, who call an MP they like. It'll be the Liberal Party. And they'll say, did we declare war on anybody? And the answer will be no. So then we should phone the troops and say, come home. We don't know why you're there. We think it has something to do with NATO. We don't run NATO. NATO belongs to somebody else. They do occasionally return our calls, not every time. So you can come home. But this business of the jets flying over the stadium, you know, the woman, by the way, did you notice the opera singers who performed
this?
Yeah,
yesterday? Renee Fleming, yeah.
Did you listen to her?
I did not.
Because Phil Conant is an authority. What's the name of the program show tomorrow, Tuesday at 12?
Classical Underground.
See, you got it right.
But she's overground. She's a world star. I don't play her in my program. I play singers you never heard of.
Well, she was. I wanted you to tell us how good she is. Is she good?
No, she's very good. Very, very good. And by the way, had her big break here in Hamilton, Ontario. That was where, when she was a young, unknown singer, she wowed the house in Hamilton, Ontario, and a year later she was a star. So that's a little piece of history.
She, by the way, she said it's not simple to do this. She
said
she
should
give a lot of thought to it. I will give her. I think that she sang the American National Anthem in a very moving way. But then they have it timed where the lights go out and then the jets fly over, the U.S. warplanes. I did notice something just at that moment. They were showing the players, and the only guy on the sidelines who nearly got whiplash watching him go was Manning. And I thought, that's odd. You don't seem to be focused here. I mean, I worried for it. When I saw him, he seemed shocked to see the warplanes go over.
How many warplanes?
They fly a little pattern. It was about three, I think.
Mm-hmm. Because they're playing this, a couple of miles, maybe 15, 20 miles from where the World Trade Center was, you know? I'm thinking that, they could scramble them for this, but they couldn't defend that building, It's
The World Trade Center? Yeah. Well, they said they called them, but they couldn't get them in the air. And you say, I thought you guys were a superpower. you never sleep, and you're out there defending us. That's what I heard. But they're getting into this worshipful phase. I recommend Dave Zirin has a column today about the militarization. I saw there was a hockey game on the weekend. I didn't watch it all, but I saw that they had military guys. I think they brought a half track onto the ice or something. And a lot of good that's going to do you if it's a nuclear war, pal. That's just brought home to me once again what a strange place we're in here, because they do these commercials are a major reason we play the Super Bowl, so that we can have the commercials. Some people only
watch that became clear. Some people wanted to watch the commercials.
Some people only watch the commercials. And I saw on CBC a commercial featured Don Cherry, and Don Cherry, I got to keep saying, he came into Toronto City Hall. He doesn't live in Toronto. After this character, Ford, got elected, They brought Don Cherry to put the chains of the office around his neck. That was before he found a bunch of other stuff around his neck. But anyhow, they brought that. They brought him there for that. And then they let him give a speech in which he insulted sitting members elected, not him, he not elected anything, abused them, mocked them, made all kinds of crazy statements. And I can't believe that a guy like that gets to do commercials. I mean, by the way, I would say to you, Torontonians, you know, you have no self-respect. Why would you buy anything connected with him? He wasn't, again, he's not part of the city. We have a city and a very important city known around the world. And he doesn't choose to live here, but he comes and makes fun of people who were elected to office here. And at the time, it was somewhat shocking, but he just, you know, we just have to grin and bear it, you know. I can guarantee you, if somebody showed up in Chicago or Montreal or Vancouver, I think, and mocked the sitting city council while not being from that city, they wouldn't be doing commercials. People say, oh, no, that's bad for our product. But Serrano, apparently you could just wipe your feet on it, you know, and or so Doug Ford thinks anyway. So that's the Super Bowl, and it was great for the start for Black History Month. From now on, Russell Wilson, Doug Williams should be featured. And when they talk about Black History, boy, did they make Black History! and each time the Denver Broncos were favored by 3, and each time they lost by more than 35 points. And the Doug Williams story was particularly poignant, if you go back and see that. There's a great legend about it. Someone who was nervous and was interviewing him said, how long have you been a black quarterback? And he said, I've been a quarterback for a certain number of years since high school, but I've been black all my life. That is, as with all great stories, that's purported to be a legend. But he was asked, did it actually happen? And he said it did happen, but of course, these things never quite happen the way they get rewritten by memory. You know, people remember the Alamo. I don't know if anybody ever, you know, or that kind of stuff. The phrases, people say, where'd that come from? And it usually turns out to be a small office in New York where somebody wrote it and put it in front of an announcer. And speaking of announcing, you're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM. This is the Taylor Report. And I want to tell you that next week, I'll tell you right now to be ready for it. We're going to have Fred Jerome, who's written 3 books about Albert Einstein, including the Einstein Letters. And he has written an article for Salon magazine titled, Let's Nationalize Fox News. Imagine a very different media, what it might be like. And that's in the January 18 issue of Salon. And it's part of a new book. That was a very prominent literary agent in New York has always wanted to do a book about why not socialism or imagine a socialist America. So she's done this, and it prompted the article by Fred Jerome on what would it be like if you had a socialist country and you had socialist media. We here at CIUT Taylor Report, we experiment with that very concept. But he will be on to talk about it next week. And by the way, we will also ask him about Albert Einstein, who was committed, I'd call him a radical socialist. If you go back and check, a Harvard economist named Paul Sweezy put together a wonderful magazine called Monthly Review, the only American academic, to my knowledge, sponsored magazine devoted to socialism and Marxist ideas and whatnot. The first issue had an essay by Albert Einstein about why he is a socialist. I have to take that back. I take the he out of it. It's why socialism and his argument for it. So that side of Einstein is not mentioned a lot by his biographers.
You know, we did a program about Einstein on our program, Classical Underground, because Einstein was a musician and had a special love of Mozart. And there's even pictures of him playing the violin, which he once did at a conference of physicists in Tokyo. He gave a paper, and everyone said, okay, that's nice. Now we'd like you to play some Beethoven. And he did.
Boy. But, okay. How? Tell us about how good a player was he?
He was an amateur, but of course he was from a time and a place where amateur musicians were good enough that you would gather in somebody's living room.
Well, could we use expression? He was no slouch.
He was not a slouch, absolutely. No, he knew, and he knew the difference between Bach and Beethoven and Mozart, and he knew how to play them. You know? Yeah. And he did. And he would regularly. That was one. And he said he would do a lot of thinking. Sometimes he'd be sitting and thinking about a mathematical problem. He'd get up. He'd go and he'd play some Mozart. And he'd come back and then he'd write out his idea.
So and Mozart solved all those problems. Yeah. That was, well, by the way, well, okay. Now you've given me more opportunity to talk about Black History Month. Incidentally, we're going to be talking to Otis Richmond fairly shortly. But Albert Einstein, together with Paul Robeson and W.E.B. Du Bois, founded an anti-lynching league society to combat lynching, which was common throughout America in the early 20th century, right straight up until the Civil Rights Movement. By the way, we still do have lynchings. Lynchings do happen, but in that, and they used to be almost really deeply sick public events in parts of the United States, and I'm not going to say only the South. Lynchings took place around the United States. There was a very famous one, or not a famous one, well known because the guy who witnessed it, the American actor Henry. Oh gosh, can't say his name. The Fonda, Henry Fonda, witnessed a lynching in Omaha, Nebraska, hometown, by the way, the birthplace of Malcolm X. So Albert Einstein and Paul Robeson organized this movement. And it is very striking. One of the things we learned by talking to Fred Jerome was that there must be hundreds of biographies, about 50, 60, you might say, serious, heavy biographies of Einstein, that none of them mention that he organized with these two major black individuals in American history, an anti-lynching group. They petitioned the President of the United States. And Paul Robeson, of course, came into under hot water, and so did W. E. Du Bois, because the Association of the Communist Party, people say, oh, the Communist Party. Just freeze that frame for one moment and ask yourself, the Democratic Party was the party of slavery before the Civil War. They were the party of segregation, apartheid in America for one century. And they say, oh, he was with the Communist Party. And what party were you with? Oh, I was with the party of slavery, and I was with the party of absolute segregation and lynching, because Democratic liberal president of the United States, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, said no when they asked him to demand, you know, change the policy, have law against lynching. Roosevelt said, I can't do it. I cannot do it. And Paul Robeson is supposed to be ashamed because he was associated with communists. Well, the communists said, let's have a law against lynching. Oh, no. Democrats said, so which party should be ashamed? And this is Black History Month. I think it's a time to ask that question. Why give Richard Wright a hard time? Why give Du Bois a hard time? How about you guys explaining Roosevelt and lynching? Or every blasted white power senator and congressman from one side of the American South to the other. And then, of course, the bigots in suits who ran the rest of the country, who practiced a different kind of segregation. So this is Black History Month, and that's why we need to talk about these things. So we're going to be speaking shortly with Norman Otis Richmond. By the way, later in the show, Joel Richardson is going to be here. Joel Richardson is quite well known to Torontonians for his murals, and he went to Occupy Wall Street. He was there, and he welcomed, and they put up his the works from his mural in during the occupation of Wall Street. Now he's got a new project. He's going to get into the movie business, and everybody gets excited when they hear about movies. So, Phil, you might want to comb your hair if you get a shot at being in a movie. I think we're joined by Norman Otis Richmond. Are you there, Norman?
Yes, sir. How are you?
Very good. This is Black History Month, and I've already begun to celebrate here. I mentioned that we have a black quarterback, started off the year, but by February by winning the Super Bowl. Now you've written a very interesting piece, and
before you say that, I have to brag because Doug Williams was from Gremlin, which is where I spent 1963 in Gremlin, and my uncle and aunt had a cleaners there, and Doug Williams was supposedly like a brother to me. I never met him, but they talked about him more than they talked about anybody else. But you know, that's neither here nor there. And also, his brother came up here and tried out for the Argos, Michael Williams, and he had a height problem. When I say, you know, quarterbacks usually are over 6 feet, and I think Michael was only about 5'11", so, but I just wanted to, I guess, give myself a plug.
Yeah, well, you're also giving a plug to Doug Williams and Grambling, which is a story in itself. That's a black university.
Oh, yeah.
And it had a man, wasn't his name Robinson, one of the great coaches?
Eddie Robinson. I wrote a story about him in the Toronto Star in 78, 79. I went to Louisiana, and I knew Coach Robinson. My aunt used to be a point guard for him when he coached a basketball team, during the 40s.
He was the winningest coach, actually, in American history.
Of course, yes, he was. No one would know that.
Competition.
Right.
That fellow over in Alabama just had good press office, that's all. again, this is Norman Otis Richmond, and who has written a very interesting piece, and this is from Negro History Week to African Liberation Month. You start off with a nice quote: "Who owns history? Not even the ones who made it, the Kumau Black August Organizing Committee."
That's Kumasi.
Oh, Kumasi, pardon me.
Yeah, Kumasi was in prison with George Jackson. He's got some great credentials.
Mm-hmm. Now, you have several tacks you take on this subject. You point out that there's been a struggle over what it signifies and also what the focus should be. Should it be African liberation? Should it be black liberation? Also, it's kind of tame, Black History Month. What are we supposed to understand about that? So give us your thoughts on this.
Well, I think that Black History Month now has been co-opted by the black petty bourgeoisie, the banks, and the hamburger chains. If you walk into, I don't want to give them any publicity, if you walk into banks or you walk into hamburger joints, you might see the kings and queens of great kings and queens of Africa, which is good, but I mean, kings and queens are about feudalism, mm-hmm. and feudalism at one point, feudalism as a social system was progressive over a slave system, but you know, we are talking about building a socialist society, mm-hmm. a classless society, so, you know, I don't think we should be digging up kings and queens. And the, basically it's been taken over by the black petty bourgeoisie in alliance with the banks and the hamburger people. Yeah. And they basically have taken Black History Month and sanitized it and made it very safe. Instead of dealing with the liberation fighters, we're bigging up Barack Obama, we're bigging up Holder, we're bigging up Susan Rice, we're bigging up Lincoln Alexander, we're bigging up dictators, African leaders and Caribbean leaders who are basically on the role of the IMF and the World Bank. They're working for them and not for their people.
Mm-hmm. This is Norman Otis Richmond, and you point out that the beginning of this, the root of this, is actually in the work of African-American historian Carter G. Woodson. What was his contribution? What was he looking to do?
Well, Carter G. Woodson, first of all, Carter G. Woodson only started school, I think, when he was 18 or 19, and he ended up going to Harvard for whatever that's worth, and he also ended up being the superintendent of the public school system in the Philippines. But basically what he wanted to do was, in African or African Liberation Month or Negro History Week at that time, was began a few years after the Berlin Conference. And, you know, Berlin Conference, 1880.
Oh, decolonization? Or what?
Yeah, 1884, 1885.
Mm-hmm.
And 15, you know, a few years later, in 1915, Woodson looked at the way black people were being portrayed all over the world and basically said, you know, we need to put together the missing pieces of world history. And what we should do, basically, is every year, we should, like, pick a subject. For example, last year or this year, what we should do is, like, if we're going to concentrate on the revolution in Haiti, which took place in 1804, and we study that for the whole year, and then we present what we found to our communities, you know, in our churches. Mm-hmm. It was a very grassroots movement, so it wasn't really where you would... It was a year-round situation. Now it's only a month situation. And, you know, there's you know, a lot of people go around speaking, which there's nothing wrong with that. But, you know, the libraries and the people, you know, bring in speakers. And I've had a lot of problems getting speaking engagements. I guess maybe next year I'll get my banjo out, maybe, you know, or my tap dancing shoes. I think, you know, they're looking for you to entertain them as opposed to educate yourself and educate the other people.
Yeah.
You know, Carter G. Woodson was one of the primary movers of this, and he basically was trying to do this because we had been ignored by the bourgeoisie, and he wasn't so much trying to prove to the bourgeoisie that we were human beings as he was basically trying to get us to organize ourselves as a people.
Mm-hmm. Well, did you... Was it in his mind at all? Do you think he would be surprised at what's become of his this initiative, of the project that he undertook?
No, because he was very suspicious of the you know, the sellout factors. Mm-hmm. I mean, he talked about the miseducation of the Negroes, and he mm-hmm. was very aware of the fact that we have an element in African people. Like in all people, you know, there's a sellout element, and you know, you know, everybody, like black people, like all people, have your revolutionaries, your working class heroes, your buffoons, your idiots, and your sellouts. So we're no different from any other group of people.
Yes. Well, yes. If people look at the folks running Washington right now, they're kind of shocked. They thought they voted for a black progressive president, and now they seem to have a Bush White House with a black president. Kind of a shock.
Well, he's a drone-dropping gentleman. I mean, he is a... I was in Louisiana just before he was elected, and he was... you know, people... He had Louisiana, he had Canada, he had the Caribbean, he had Africa, and I didn't think he was going to do anything because he's going to have to represent the U.S. the imperialists, but I didn't think he was going to be this bad. I didn't really think he would bomb Libya.
Yeah, he's kind of like the Denver Broncos.
And he's a drone. He's a drone fanatic. He just drone.
No, it is. By the way, that should become a component in the course in the work you do and others is evaluating this phenomenon. We're speaking to Norman Otis Richmond, and I want to ask, you and I both know a wonderful entertainer who is going to have a great show, and she's really works on black roots, and this is Tiki Mercury Clark. Can you tell me what Tiki's got planned?
She's doing a show, and she's definitely a proponent of African Liberation Month and Black History. She's doing a show at a place called Bellinese, I think, and it's at 4440. That's 4000 Steel Street Avenue, Unit 14, and that's going to be on the 16th of February. And she has a whole new show. She has a whole new show. I want to pull it up now, so I can give her some play. But she's doing a whole show. She basically has a CD out where she goes from Kemet, which is Egypt, to what's taking place in Canada right now. So she takes us, you know, through Africa, through the Caribbean, and through all the way up to Canada. But she'll be doing that show on February the 16th. I have it right here. She's celebrating the heroes and sheroes, and it's the roots of gospel music, and that's mm-hmm. a Sunday, February the 16th, and definitely I think we should support Tiki because Tiki's yeah. always supported us, including long, when I say yeah. us, I mean us.
Yeah, as long as I can remember, Tiki has always been the one who was there, whether it was the Bad Sea or Charles Roach and all the great names in the struggles against racism and police brutality here in Toronto, and I guess across the country as well. She's always been there, and what a great voice, and her command of the history of the music is second to none.
Yeah, well, you know, like they said, like the Cubans used to say. We used to say when Cuba called when Africa called, Cuba answered. And I would say that when we called, Tiki answered because, like, she has supported a different book list. She supported me. She supported Haiti. She supported if she sees the cause as being just, she will give you a play.
Just to repeat, so she's going to, it's February, the dates again are, and where?
Sunday, February the 16th, it's at a place called Bellinese, I believe. Bellinese, I might be mispronouncing it because I can't basically speak.
Well, the beauty of the Internet, all people have to do is put Tiki Mercury Clark, and it goes, it'll tell us quicker than you and I can remember.
Right.
And now,
4000 Stills Avenue West.
Avenue
Unit 14, and the phone number is 905-264-0001. I'm on a computer, and don't have my glasses on, so I hope I didn't give any misinformation.
This is Norman Otis Richmond. He's currently working as a producer host Saturday morning live on Radio Regent, And Norman, this article, where can people go to find your latest article on Black History Month?
Well, it's on my Facebook page. But if you wanted I can send it to you directly. You can email me at norman.o.richmond@gmail.com. That's norman.o.richmond@gmail.com. And I'm also on Uhuru Radio. Every Sunday from 2 to 4.
Well, we really appreciate it, Norman. We both of us look forward to seeing Tiki. She's going to be a great performer. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Okay,
take care of yourself.
That's Norman Otis Richmond. I would call him a local legend. By the way, Norman is a great singer. Have you ever heard Norman sing?
I have heard him talk many times. I haven't heard him sing.
You have missed something. There's a guy who's too shy about his talent. I think when he's around, people ought to ask him to perform.
We should put him on the air at CIUT.
you have a musical show. Right. You've given yourself an assignment. You're listening to the Taylor Report, CIUT 9.5 FM. One item I want to make sure I call attention to. Everyone's reading and hearing about the Ukraine and noticed something. That there's a difference of opinion in that country. The members of the opposition do not like the decision taken by the government, and the opposition are not the majority in that country. And they've begun to have demonstrations, and they've become quite militant, let's put it that way. And I've been very struck by this, that demonstrations of this type are generally not tolerated in our society. Just look, a guy got sentenced today for his G8 activity, and he got a long sentence, by the way. But the John McCain, who is not, in my opinion, a friend of the people, he went right into Kiev and gave a big speech about how Ukraine should be with the West, and he talks about Europe. So I think we ought to have a geography lesson. Russia is part of Europe. It is. And there's another word they use, which is, they use it like it's a dirty word. That's Asia. Asia is not a dirty word. line that people are creating is actually an appeal to our worst side. This, to say Asian is not to say anything other than geography. One of the most advanced and rapidly developing countries, two of the most, India and China, are in what they call Asia. So this is beginning to get a little outrageous. But also, there are people appearing at these demonstrations, and one of them I want to remark on because the Toronto Star didn't want to help me out. They ran a photograph of a guy who was killed. He was being carried in a coffin through the square, by the way, an open coffin in Kiev. And they said, well, you know, here he is. Nothing in the story tells me about the men carrying the coffin, but I have two eyes, and I see they're all wearing the same shoulder patch. And that's the shoulder patch of the Ukrainian Self-Defense Force. And that isn't just anybody. That's a paramilitary right-wing. I emphasize, it is a right-wing group. And they seem to have honor of place. This is not a mixed group. These guys all are wearing dungarees, and they're all wearing that shoulder patch. And I learned by simple research that they were fighting in Georgia on behalf of the Georgian government against the Russians in Abkhazia. They're proud of that. It's not a secret. We are getting unquestioned reports. I have in front of me a report from an interview with a rabbi in Kiev, and he says, unfortunately, this is Rabbi Borak Gorin of the Federation of Jewish Communities of Russia, and he called on the authorities to place Jewish community institutions in Kiev under protection. And he says, this is a quote, unfortunately, under the opposition leaders and opposition forces, well-defined anti-Semitic speeches have already been recorded, he said, in an apparent reference to the ultra-nationalist Svoboda Party. This is extremely dangerous. I couldn't agree more, and particularly because our major newspapers don't want to discuss the matter. And they're treating it as though, oh, you're just watching a big, peaceful demonstration. You got paramilitaries who fought in Georgia. That's not your ordinary peaceful demonstration. We're going to take a break. It's a Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. We'll take a little break, and we are going to be back with Joel Richardson, artist and now filmmaker.